A few years ago, when I was very much feeling the lack of judgment of the type I was thinking of, the judgment of good or bad, or degrees of that, and what that means to a person, to a recipient, a living recipient, I started with myself a certain game. You know, you all know the Simpsons, and you know all know that the Simpsons are everywhere, wherever you are in the world, they are broadcasted everywhere. And they're broadcasted everywhere, every day. And it's in most countries of the world, the Simpsons are on at 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, in a time when still kids are watching unwatched, but they're also the parents already home so that everyone can see it. So whenever there was one of those Friday evenings when all the galleries opened, and I was about to see ten or fifteen shows, mostly disappointing shows that never ever were named disappointing. They were just disappointing. I played this game with myself let's compare the quality of today's episode of The Simpsons with what I'm going to see there. And this is, of course, referring to Will's quote of Sven Lütiken earlier, that the cultural industry is always the bad cop and art is the good cop. And this quite often it was proven that this is not the case in this game. Quite often the cultural industry won in terms of quality, in terms of judgments that I could defend with reasons based on the two major questions: what kind of a thing is it that I'm experiencing here? What is it supposed to be? Is it that what it is supposed to be? And do I like that it wants to be what it is or what it wants to be? Do I think this is a project that's adequate? The situation quite often was that I think that this game basically expressed or explained that the general question: why do we generally assume that it's good that there is art out there, or that there is so many art out there, or so much art out there? It could be less, and could be different things. It could be completely different kind of projects, or it could be music, or it could be something else. Or it could be maybe brainwashing cultural industrial products that are not the brainwashing after all. Whatever. But different from other things I would not like in the outside world, like certain forms of public transport, SUVs, certain boutiques, I could still think of writing a review. I could still think of writing a critique and explaining why I would not like this. And of course, I would not want it really to go away. Why should it? But I could at least express this, whereas I could not do that with boutiques, forms of public transport, or SUVs. They would not go away. I could only attack them with a stone or something like that. So that is kind of the starting point for this paper that was originally called Judgment, Objecthood, and Temporality. And I was very glad to have hear already by Maria a lot about the temporal aspect of the confrontation with art objects. Judgments, especially negative judgments of value, have an increasingly bad press. Opinions are relative, debates remain open, and results are postponed. People should rather interact than judge. That is the widespread attitude among artists and curators these days, and theoreticians seem to agree. To complain about this is also indeed widespread, like Tilda yesterday pointed out. But I don't think it's just a call or a return to order. It can also lead to a leap forward into a new or a specific adequate historical idea of judgment. I think it's basically ironicism which refuses or does not like any ideas of normativity or judgments, because the ironicist is basically observing discourses not for their argumentative transitive value, but for their object value, their beauty, their newness, their structural complexity. And of course, I sympathize with that as well, but I also disagree. I disagree from the perspective of my aesthetic experience. I think what Tilda did yesterday was, to a degree, leading to some kind of this ironicist conclusion or this ironicist perspective, but different from the vulgar ironicist, he was giving us good reasons for ironicisms, which the ironicist normally never does. The ironicist shies away from good reasons because he or she cannot accept good reasons at all. So I understand this, but I disagree. But even more do I disagree with the attempt to politicize the very avoidance of judgment. Here, these were programmatic and normatively anti-normative statements of a Viennese conference on the state of art criticism or art critique today. I quote, "What is critique? It is certainly not simply a practice of judging, much less of condemning. It may be that these kinds of reactive, abbreviated forms of critique, in quotation marks, charged with resentment, are still being preached from pulpits of academic teaching and announced from within the bunkers of art criticism, a practice that is perhaps even stronger than ever. In a contemporary concept of critique, however, it can no longer be a matter of more or less rigorous yes or no to a certain object." These are words rejecting an idea of critique that I'm also, of course, would not propose. I would indeed agree that it is a reductivist idea to limit critique or criticism or art writing, for that matter, to judgment. One could, for example, say that this would identify the process with the result. It would narrow down the result to the simplicity of yes or no, where I was talking of degrees. But there was something in these programmatic sentences which were really irritating me, and that was this kind of blatant irrealism. To say condemning and negative judgment stronger than ever, where is that? In which bunkers of art criticism? And where in the discourse of academic teaching? Where are you finding this in the art world? If there's anything that you've never reading anywhere in any art journal or art magazine, it is a negative judgment against any show, project, book, catalog, or anyone involved in the fine art world. This simply does not exist anymore. It never existed very widespreadly, but it existed, but it does not exist anymore. And those who have, people who, writers, critics I know who were harsh or aggressive, especially politically aggressive in their criticism in the early 90s, most of them are no longer in the business of art writing, at least not in the business of art writing in art journals. Some of them, or most of them, if they still continue in that field of journalism and writing, they are now writing about public art projects or cultural politics, things where they are attacking the government, political decisions. That is always possible. But if you are, then you are becoming Benjamin Google or something like that. But you have to live somewhere in these 20 or 30 years. You have to find some Halifax or exception. And if you look at other forms of criticism, if you look away from art criticism, you have the same, as at least in the quality press, newspaper criticism of cinema. It's increasingly the case that you don't find any negative criticism anymore. The only type of negative criticism you find in the cinema world is in trade papers, and then it's always in a result to commercial success. They're saying this movie sucks, but it does because it doesn't look good at the box office. They don't have any relation to aesthetic experiences. This is the same in most arts. I think the only exception, at least in the European situation, which I know more of, are theatre and classical music. Here, at least, some old-school bourgeois papers, who nobody's taking seriously anyway, keep up a traditional form of review culture in which negation and condemning is still possible, But unfortunately, only when you argue extremely traditional. And that, I think, is the big misunderstanding, to think that a judgment is only possible with traditional forms, where there is a large tradition of how to do certain things, and only if you know, if there is a tradition of how to do certain things, you can judge them properly. I think it's the other way around, but it has to become a certain form of criticism that has to, of course, it cannot rely on rules that already exist. It has to come up with them, but they have to be rules that can be defended. So, as you already might have smelled, I want to make a point for a practice of criticism which eventually produces judgments, and of course not final and holy judgments, but judgment of value. And although I hope to come up in the end with some ideas of a certain practice of judging that I will find dependable, as opposed to the pseudo-noble withdrawal from judging, I want to discuss an antagonistic constellation that I found in one of the texts of the Viennese symposium that I mentioned earlier. Organizer Gerald Raunig refers to distinctions based on Michel Foucault's text, What is Critique?, and a reading of that Foucault piece by Judith Butler. In this discussion, he makes a distinction between critique as an open process, a general perspective towards the world, and a narrow-minded expectation of a practical and useful instrument that helps you to get through the world, basically through a world of consumption. And Raunig quotes Butler as having argued critique to be the very process which suspends judgment. This idea of critique as a process-oriented attitude gravitates rather towards a description of people, their personal mindset, their self-image, their morality. It's a kind of ethical imperative, not so much directed at a practice, but as your personal, the way you are. It does not describe this discursive side of a discursive practice, but the personal, psychological, habitual side of it. This critique might, though, still be a discursive practice, but in order to conceive it that way, as a suspension of judgment, it must be thought of as a discursive activity involving living people, not just critical or theoretical production, not objects, not words, not sentences, not contradictions, but living, breathing people. This suspension of judgment can only make sense as a quasi-aesthetic and or ethic practice, aesthetical and or ethical practice, which organizes itself around the life of thought and its infinity and physicality. It is by no means the asymmetrical activity of people vis-à-vis objects or vis-à-vis the world, which one might associate with critical practice in the first place. Instead, it describes people vis-à-vis themselves, how they grow, develop, avoid, play, and maybe even produce, but all from a position of sovereignty and self-control and even narcissism, maybe. And actually, I really like the three jackets of us here on the panel. I think we're all wearing eight jackets. Here's a very different idea of critique or criticism, involving a lot of value judgments. I'm talking about value judgment and criticism in the discourse of what I chose to call emergent people, young ones, recently immigrated, recently arrived, recently starting to speak, or recently being allowed to speak, and so on. Vis-à-vis an already finished world of objects. I think, however, this position can also be found where the ones who adopt it are not necessarily really that new and emergent on the planet or in the society in question, but somehow have a stable relation of outsideness or excludedness. Butler refers in the text I mentioned above to Raymond Williams, claiming that one should think of critique as a never finalized practice instead of a teleological activity leading to judgments. But it is exactly this possibility to arrive at judgments which makes this particular critical activity an unstoppable one. It is exactly because it articulates seemingly final decisions all the time, this other form of critique that I'm talking now about, the one by emergent people. So it can never stop. It has to permanently rediscuss what it has seemingly decided for good. only because the sentence has the seriousness and the investment of a final decision and an eternal damnation, it will be discussed over and over again and can be exactly what Raymond Williams is asking for. Of course, the subtext of Foucault's, Williams, and Butler's privileging of a critical attitude, a critical project over critical judgment, is the ethics of politicization, the ethics of political activity or even activism. Be it in a revolutionary sense, referring to some normative idea of turning your life around, turning it into a responsible revolutionary one, be it in a democraticist sense as a normative idea of participation and involvedness, permanent questioning and constant skepticism of official truth. It owes its idea of a criticality which reaches the entire body of the critical subject to ideas and lifestyles of the 60s and after, which are based on the idea that everyone should change his, her life and live holistically the ideas he or she has, as opposed to a bad old bourgeois double standard. I have to say, anticipating slightly some arguments I want to come back later to, that I grew up in solidarity with these ideas, still holding them dear, but that I feel unable to resist the consequence of the observation that the investment of your whole life, the ethics of a holistic existence, the exploitation not of labor but of life force, is exactly the motor of contemporary forms of capitalism, the cultural logic we've been looking for yesterday and still always looking for. Now, in order to go back, this existentialism of the critical position, to call it that, as a slightly polemic exaggeration, which is a bit unfair to Foucault because he, of course, knew about the dangers of existentialism. This existentialism is opposed to the seemingly apolitical consumer whose judgment of value are nothing more than judgment of exchange value, at best judgment of a certain economic rationality vis-a-vis a form of use value, but not and never free judgments. They are related to a necessity based on the facts of life. And this is another aspect of the Butler-Foucault-Williams argument. This argument is not based on necessity, and this existentialism is not based on necessity. It basically is proud to be not based on necessity. Aesthetic judgment in its classical form, at least from the German tradition, is on the other hand connected to an idea of judgment without any relation to a worldly interest in the art object, any use value of it as a thing in daily life. Instead, it is based on a suspension of any use value as well as exchange value in a different sphere of general openness towards pleasure, to a pleasure which is not related to instrumentality and calculable gain. The conditions for the ability or capacity to receive and enjoy artistic objects that particular way can, of course, be historically as well as sociologically be located. They can be found in a fully developed Western bourgeois culture beginning somewhere around 1750, I would say. They were first theoretically studied and systematized in a book by Immanuel Kant, which is in the English-speaking world known as the Critique of Judgment, although it should better be translated the Critique of the Capacity of Judgment. This capacity assumes, without declaring that explicitly, that he or she who makes an artistic experience is carefree and safe enough to look at an object without desperately needing its use value. This is what Kant calls the uninterested pleasure. The designation of these conditions as Western and bourgeois might be a judgment, even a condemning one. But I'm introducing it here as a technical term, or as technical terms. I'll come to judgments later. But there are two possibilities connected with this classification. One is devaluating the aesthetic experience by describing it as something which is only affordable by the ruling class. Whatever this experience might intrinsically be, it cannot be human in general or universal. If it is A, exclusive, and B, even constitutive to the exclusiveness as one of the key elements of bourgeois ideology, to connect this definition of a full human being by his or her aesthetic capacities. Second, one might say there is nothing intrinsically wrong with good wine or a pleasant country house. It is only a problem of uneven distribution. Maybe the same is true for uninterested pleasure at the heart of the bourgeois conception of aesthetic experience. Maybe uninterested as a synonym for unforced, not driven by necessity, despair, need, etc., is perfectly an agreeable idea of an aesthetic experience as a kind of utopian break with the management of daily duties and outside forces. And its only problem is the fact that this kind of experience is not available, and less and less available and accessible for everyone. Or does one have to say, on the other hand, that anything which can be distributed uneven, anything which can be distributed uneven successfully, can never be qualified as material for any conception of utopian ideas? That would be the other possibility. But whatever our decision about this, the conception of critique as suspension of judgment, so I will argue, is both an extension of the bourgeois idea of aesthetic experience as essentially unconnected to necessity and instrumentality. It only replaces the aesthetic with the critical. But it is as well an extension of the critical impulse from an object and result-oriented activity to one that includes any human capacity. And that is good. Critique, that is how this discourse argues, was supposed to serve a banal, nearsighted purpose born out of necessity and need. But it is supposed to become an aesthetic of how to live. That is, in a way, the aestheticized synthesis of the previously introduced two possibilities of critique as a normative idea of a way of life, either revolutionary or democratic participatory. In an incorporated, fully internalized lifestyle of critique or the critical, even this decision, the one between revolution or reform, is suspended and delayed for later. But since this seems to be an ambivalent maneuver, because it is extending the critical impulse, which we agree about, but at the same time limiting it by cutting off its capacity to interfere, judgment, which we disagree about, I will not pass from my side a final judgment on this discourse. I will postpone this, just as they tend to endlessly postpone judgment. But I promise not to be endless. So we have two groups here that I've introduced and two different forms of judging. Group one is judging enthusiastically. They are emergent participants of the market in the societies in questions. They were constituting what once was called youth culture, for example. But among them you also find social climbers and other recent newbies to a different society or those recently arrived in a different social stratum. Simon Friss describes their idea of judging in his book Performing Rights. Quote, "Good and bad, or their vernacular versions, brilliant and crab, are the most frequent terms in everyday cultural conversation. Though all of us knew that what was at issue in a certain conversation he was referring to was personal taste, subjective response, we also believed passionately at times that we were describing something objectively in the music, if only other people could hear it. Value arguments, in other words, aren't simply rituals of I like, you like. They are based in reason, evidence, persuasion. Every music fan knows that moment of frustration when one can only sit the person down and say, or rather shout despairingly, but just listen to her. Isn't she fantastic? The other group not only shies away from that moment because they mostly are better educated academics who are not shouting judgments of value at other people. This deep conviction is in their education that a judgment of value is nothing that you can is something that you cannot force upon someone else. It's also shaping the idea of critique as a non-normative, non-conventional project, something that cannot be played by rules because it is precisely about the questioning of rules. And if there are no rules, there is also no judgment. This is the program of a critical left that implicitly argues that the lesson from earlier communist and other radical leftist history is not to become a reformist because of all the defeats and failures, but to even radicalize a certain unpragmatic relationship towards power and its execution, and thus to moralistically depoliticize radicalism and turn it into an aesthetic position. The last thing, of course, remains implicit, and that is, and it's only in my polemic. At this moment, you might already smell a certain class analytical conclusion of this talk. Academic radical refusal versus young proletarian enthusiasm. The first ones, cowards, but correct cowards, and at least a little bit utopian. The second ones, sympathetic enthusiasts, but maybe only by paying the price of selling their judgment-ready enthusiasm to consumerism. But I would like to try something different at this point. I would like to look at what kind of object both discourses assume to be judging, and if an object at all. And I want to look at the relation between subjectivity and judgment in relation to the specificities of the different forms of value. The case Friss refers to A heated debate among fans on a ferry boat from Stockholm to Britain refers to music. The shouting fan forcing his enthusiasm upon a non-believer in his story refers to a song and its singer. Music, although it can be stored and reproduced, altered and rearranged or remixed, has a strange object ontology. It is normally considered to be essentially immaterial and thus not objectifiable. Music fans, of course, have fetishistic relations to records and other objects related to musical performances, and the whole emotionally loaded talk would not be possible if there was not some kind of shared idea of the objectivity and reality of the experience all these fans had and probably could at least try to reconstruct by playing a record or a file. But the experience itself is strongly one of temporality. It is about how things are happening within a time span, which is experienced as beyond the control of the listener or the recipient. You are placed in the time continuum in a manner that resembles the way you are situated in the time span that limits your very lifetime. How does one deal with value under these conditions? What is valuable in relation to a lifetime whose length is beyond your control, but whose texture is not only not beyond your control, but essentially your major obligation? In music, happenings occur against time. Time is made enjoyable by dividing it up in funky beats. Endings are suspended by repetitions, then not. They are played with. All the elements are exposed to a dialectics of convention and surprise. All these occurrences add up to a discussion of the value of life in relation to time, in an anthropological sense as much as in a political sense. This implies that not only openness and contingency, but more precisely a ratio between high emotional involvement that has to be to a degree a passive one, not being able to change the musical course, at best being identified with it, and on the other hand, ways out, ways not to become fully subjected to the course of the beats and the chords, would also be valued highly. These things are dialectically connected. But that is already a description from outside of the emotionally involved listening process. This is an abstraction of that. The description of an algorithm of musical enjoyment. Rather, one has to describe the impulse to judge as the main tool by which the listeners position themselves within the continuum that forces them otherwise to be emotionally passive. Their tendency towards final judgments, total agreement or disagreement, does not only reflect the emotionality of the connection between all time-based arts to the urgency and the need to decide in real time, which is characteristic for life itself, and for politics, especially life in a capitalist system in which you sell your workforce by the hour. It also appropriates the sovereignty to decide about finality, about conclusions from the aesthetic process, which is dominated by the artist and the scenario. It is the attempt to participate, or one can even say it is a participation, which is specific to time-based arts. They are all plays on the temporality of life and its economy. But symbolically, they offer the ability to intervene in this temporality to the audience, although they are the ones who are exposed to the temporality in regular life. In the reversal of classical catharsis, this is not an effect they experience later, but all the time. All the time you experience this. Whereas the anti-cathartic judgment used to intervene, to interrupt, to make themselves heard, interrupts in itself their being exposed to the domination of time. Music, in a strict sense, if you do not think of it as commodities like scores or records, music has no value. It cannot be produced and then later be used, which is the condition for value. All things that have a value have even also they have a use value, and of course, all things that have an exchange value have this basis. This non-value is at the same time its commonality with life itself. It is of course a huge value when connected with the future of a human being, his, her body and his, her knowledge. The life of a person, his, her life force, his, her living energy, his, her possible future, all these are not only biopolitical items of investment, but already have been values for many industries back in pre-biopolitical days, when the attributes of liveliness or living energy were still transformed via discipline into regular old-fashioned labor. But from the perspective of the living being, of the recipient of music, the overwhelmment he or she experiences lies in the commonality with his or her own life as open and undecided, which causes euphoria and panic. That is why conventions in music are so often needed and welcomed. because they anchor it in what is felt like objectivity and external rules. Judgment helps. That is at least one of its functions. It helps to make the panic and the euphoria tolerable and translatable. It's socializing it. But at the same time, they make the experience of overwhelmment one to be shared on another a discursive level. That is a level where this experience becomes manageable in a cooler temperature, with more distance and sovereignty. It also allows establishing rules around it, building groups and gangs, constructing social scenes and social sense. The judgment of value bridges immediacy and self-organization. It comes before any other form of reflection steps in. Partly it is mimicking the bureaucracy of regular culture. Partly it is the most passionate translation imaginable of experience into discourse. This is great, this is crap. In this area of tension, the birth of subcultures and other audiences is situated. Art objects, on the other hand, have their own management of time. They are also understood by its recipients in relation to the temporality. But in the case of objects, it is a sublimely endless period of existence they're referring to. And that is even also true if they are not really a material, not really existing forever. It's if they are indeed a whole piece that is going to rot in right while we speak, even that is conceived or perceived as an object that exists forever. They are either old or they are going to be old, incredibly old. They are looked at with the idea of ars longa, and that is even a valid idea if you talk about, like I said, ephemeral or process or project-oriented art. The main idea is that we have time, because the object-related experience is based on the difference between our lifetime and its senses of temporality and another temporality, which is not based in human lifespans, but on truces and experiences which remain to be seen or experienced in the future. All these art objects that we have any relation to are going to exist for a very long time, and many, many, many other people are going to say something about it. And that is the very relaxing and very relaxing situation in which we deal with them. The distinction between art that only works in an immediate relation to our living here and now and such art that has something to say in 100 years is normally based on quality, complexity, old-fashioned judgments of value, or it is deconstructed right away. By relating this distinction to the difference between object and process, declaring thus also called high art to objects in a way and all subcultural art to processes, and then base these distinctions on the differences between two sensory practices, visual object production versus oral social temporality, we come to another basis for judgment of value. They lead to the distinction between art that can be an investment in the future and sound that can only hedonistically taken in, swallowed, gobbled, and has no value at all. Both of these categories of value transcend the Marxist distinction between use value and exchange value. Since both Marxist categories, as I have indicated earlier, rely on the idea that an object or a tool will be used later, can be stored before usage, can be integrated into some ecology of people and thus build an economy by starting exchange. Music in its original format cannot be used later. Art objects can never be used anyway because they exist forever and forever is always after us and they have no use value. They're outside of that. They can be exchanged, yes, but only in an always unfinished process of speculation. Different from regular speculation, the exchange value is not based on a specific date. It is no surprise, then, that by constantly judging, the first group tries to symbolically stop the non-reversible passing of their life, whereas the other avoids judging because this would undermine the very ontology of the art object. But it does not stop there. The aesthetic experience is really endless, but only, and that is its dialectic, in relation to the physicality of a mortal human being. The endlessness cannot be experienced in eternity, but in time. In the same way, the total presence of living the experience can only be tolerated by erecting bureaucratic history writing, an attempt to collect experience like you collect photos in photo albums. But as much as this activity tends to not develop a reflexive relation to its administration of nostalgia, the relation between speculation, history writing, and the non-objective individual remains non-reflected in many contemporary art debates. Two historic positions have produced, and I'm going to disappoint you with these proposals, methodologies that might be useful in this context. One is the politicization of pop music. The other is the politicized aestheticism of the Frankfurt School. The first was implicitly arguing that the tension of interdisciplinary pleasure, the time management of Fordist capitalism, could be articulated in various forms of syncopated or irregularly rhythmic music, integrated into a larger participatory art form that was not so much based on the expressionism of their protagonist, but on their ability to offer territory for projections, debates, identification, more or less progressive psychological and discursive activities by the audience. There's no doubt that time management became the content of many of the decisive changes and paradigm shifts in pop music and its history. Massive acceleration, punk, or massive slowing down, reggae, could mark at least for a certain time the same change, the same paradigm shift. Gestures and practices of endlessness as an endless improvisation or an endless raves would also initiate paradigm shifts. In most cases, those were attempts to break with the object ontology of music and reappropriate music as a time-based practice. One of its key methods would be the uninterrupted judging with the adequate gesture of finality, while at the same time renegotiating every judgment all of the time. The aesthetic position of the classic Frankfurt School, on the other hand, has, as articulated mainly by Adorno himself, but also by some of his followers, like the writer, theorist, and composer Hans G. Helms, or musicologist Heinz-Klaus Metzger, tried to relocate the work of art and the aesthetic experience with some quasi-heroic gesture, completely outside of the management of everyday life, outside not only of use degenerated into instrumentality, in exchange as the false equivalence of capitalism, but also outside the bourgeois psychological need for life after death provided by art. Both positions are based on radical assumptions against which one can measure or judge actual results, contemporary results. They produce categories that are not deducted from a pragmatic discourse of art practice, but from impossibility. Both positions will never be content, but in the meantime, they will applaud the euphoric moment that can only last a few seconds, screaming in the first case, or ask for the even more increased negation in the second case. Basically, these are the positions that make it possible to realize how judgment of value are related to temporalities. In the case of the pop music enthusiast or performance enthusiast or time-based art enthusiast, it's all about the utopia of the moment. For the critical theory-influenced critic of art objects or music objects, it's all about the critique of bourgeois eternity. But in both cases, it is the category of history which makes the types of judgment productive. In the first case, the history of great moments, the history of suspended time, the history of syncopation and suspension of temporality. In the second case, the critique of eternity in the name of history, which might be as long, but as opposed to eternity, it is not empty. History not as a narcissistic idea of magnifying my life, but of objectifying it. Without some necessarily complicated idea of history, judgment is not possible. Especially the critique of recuperation, of devaluation, and revaluation of certain artistic values and values of emancipation by turning them into the engine of capitalist production, our contemporary critique of post-Fordism, is not possible without the comparatism which looks at the differences between historical stages. You have to be able to think progress in order to criticize regression. This is a banality, but sometimes has to be said. Everybody does criticize regression, and in the reactionary, but nobody these days acknowledges at the same time that any reactionary attack on possibilities of life in our lifetime can only be perceived if your perception is based on an alternative normativity. Thank you.